Dr. Novick is one of the co-educational directors at Hidden Sparks and the dean of the Azrieli Graduate School of Jewish Education and Administration at Yeshiva University, and holds the Rain and Stanley Silverstein Chair in Professional Ethics and Values. She served for many years as the coordinator of child psychology in the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Schneider Children's Hospital, and as the clinical director of the Alliance for School Mental Health, providing outreach services, treatment, and training to schools, families, and communities. She developed the Brave Bully Prevention Program and is a trained cognitive behavioral therapist with her own private practice. As one of two educational directors for Hidden Sparks, Dr. Novick provides training, supervision, and ongoing mentoring to the Hidden Sparks teams of coaches, principals, and internal coaches, and she has been featured in an Ellie Talk. Okay, Rona, I am going to give the controls over to you.
Terrific.
And the floor is all yours.
Okay. Welcome, everybody, and good evening. We're going to talk tonight about those factors that contribute to classroom conflict, both when it's conflict that's directed at you or it's between student and teacher, as well as when it's conflict between two students in a classroom. And we're going to focus on strategies that manage situations as they escalate and how we might regroup after an escalating conflict. Think about how easy it is to make things worse or bad, or to make things harder than they need to be. Consider what happened on Tuesday when Mrs. Cohen asked her class to take out their homework. Joey was playing with something on his desk, and Mrs. Cohen asked him to put it away and hurry up to take out his homework. Now, Mrs. Cohen is not a terrible teacher. She's a great teacher. And all of us, if we're honest, will admit to having days like this where, just as Mrs. Cohen did, we might approach the student who is not getting his work done. When this happened, though, Rachel, who sits right in front of Joey, laughed, and Joey then yelled at her. So Mrs. Cohen approached the desk and said, we don't speak that way in this class, Joey. Joey says, I'll talk how I want to. And Mrs. Cohen thought in her head, this is the third time this week Joey is starting out a day with trouble. So she said to Joey, Joey, it's going to be another day like yesterday. Let's just get out the homework. Joey grabbed his pencil and screamed, I hate this class, and began pounding his pencil into the desk. Now, we can all be Monday morning quarterbacks, and we can look at this and say, well, I would have, and I should have, and Mrs. Cohen should have. But in reality, we have lots of interactions like this where we may make a situation much harder than it needs to be. Now, I just want to think for a moment, take a step back, and before we get to crisis and de-escalate, realize why this is so important. Because what we really want, the goals that we want to support developing for all students, is we want every student to be self-aware. We want every student to be able to manage themselves. We want every student to have social awareness, to be able to understand the people around them and track their feelings and responses. We want them to be responsible decision makers, and we want them to develop relationship skills. This array of skills is actually, both New York State and New Jersey have identified these as the core social-emotional learning competencies that students need in order to successfully manage frustration, handle conflict, and to de-escalate when something upsets them. I often recall the moment when my 4-year-old granddaughter was handing out toys to each one of us, clearly playing the role of teacher. And as she handed each one of us a toy, she said, you get what you get and don't get upset. And we all thought that was adorable. And clearly she was mimicking something that she hears in her preschool. When I shared this with an expert preschool educator, she said to me, that's really, you know, that's so 1980s. We now know that what we really have to tell students is you get what you get and you can get upset. But if you get upset and you have the skills of self-awareness, self-management, social awareness, et cetera, then you get upset, but you handle it in an appropriate way, without creating an escalating conflict. So we are not asking or expecting that students will live their life with no trouble, no crises that escalate them, but we expect that things will trigger them and set them off. Before I get to this slide, just please, it's very lonely if I don't see anything in the chat room. So what I'd love to suggest is that as I'm talking, take a moment and enter in the chat room something that you've noticed that escalates or triggers students in your classroom. Now, one of the things that we have to keep in mind, because it's very tempting to say, well, you know, I teach math or I teach reading, but, you know, I can't teach children how to manage themselves. Tom Herner, who was the National Association of State Directors of Special Ed president, wrote in 1998, I think, this brilliant comment that when a child doesn't know how to read, we teach. And when a child doesn't know how to swim, we teach them. And if a child doesn't know how to multiply, we teach them. And if a child doesn't know how to drive, we teach them. But if a child doesn't know how to behave, we almost always think punishment. We don't think, if this child doesn't know how to behave, then I have to teach them some skills so that they do know. And thank you. I'm seeing now these great ideas in the chat room of all of the things that escalate students. A lot of them have to do with change and unexpected consequences or unexpected things that happen in the school. I just want to comment on this summer, someone heard you get what you get and you say thank you. The truth of the matter is I'm fine with saying to students, you get what you get and it's all right to say you're upset. Just use your words, use them appropriately. There's a way to say, you know, you don't have to lose every game and say, hooray, I lost. It's okay to say, I'm really upset that I lost. I think I blew that game. But you don't have to, you know, throw over tables and chairs while you're saying it. Some of the things that we need to invest in before we can even consider how we deal with conflict, because we're going to leverage them in the context of conflict in order to de-escalate the situation. So one thing we have to invest in is relationships. You have no power to influence or teach, or certainly if we're in danger situations, control a child, or you have limited power if you mean nothing to that child and if they mean nothing to you. The more we matter to our students and the more they feel that they matter to us, the more we can be influencers that can help them, that can strategize with them, and that can support them making good behavioral choices, and the more we can share with them behavioral options. Another investment are clear expectations and procedures and routines. Now, I see all the comments about transitions and changes and unexpected things and et cetera, things you can't predict, but imagine if your entire day was unpredictable, or if in your classroom, most days it's not a problem that I call out without waiting to be called on, but today you're giving me a very difficult time when I call out. Most days it doesn't bother you that my desk is a mess, but today you're reacting in a different way. Not being clear about your expectations, not having procedures in place, makes it harder for students to self-manage and plan and maintain their control. It is a huge investment before any conflict to know your students and understand them, to know that really loud noises are going to set off Yussi, and that not giving a warning that it's time to put away materials is going to make Shira have very difficult time with the transition. But equally important is understanding yourself. How many of us, I wish we had in the chat room a hand-raising function. We don't, but you can share your thoughts if you like. How many of us have come into a classroom and because we were up late last night, or because we had a harrowing morning with our own children at home, or the traffic was terrible, walk into the classroom not our best selves? And how many of us, in the reverse direction, come home and begin our evening with our spouse, our children, our loved ones, our partners, our friends, not in the best way because something aggravated us at work? We have to really think about what are our triggers and are we reacting in a reasonable way? Are we being true to what's in this situation and not grouping things together in a way that's escalating? And finally, we should think about, have we invested sufficiently in building students' self-management, self-regulation skills? Now, the time to do this is not in the middle of a conflict. We do not walk over to Joey as he's stabbing his pencil into his desk and say, Joey, I'd like to teach you some deep breathing and relaxation. That is a mistake. It might even be a mistake to walk over to Joey and say, you know that deep breathing and relaxation we learned last week or yesterday? Try it now. We want to build the skills in calm moments, have them be overlearned and ingrained so that we can refer to those skills and prompt those skills in times of need. And thank you for those people who use the chat room to self-reveal that sleep is a very big issue and that they are not as patient a person when they have not slept the night before. Now, the traditional strategies for addressing problem behavior, for addressing escalating behavior, include timeout. I've, you know, pictured them here. Timeout, demerits, detention, a phone call home, assignments. And again, feel free to use the chat room. Can you think of others? But what you'll notice about all of these is that they are negative and punitive. They are not things that when you say to a student who is in a bad place and in a bad moment, because we would not be using these strategies if the student were doing well. So in a bad moment, we are saying to a student, you got detention, or I'm calling home, or you have an additional assignment or timeout, etc. What is the reaction that a student who is already unraveling is likely to have? They're likely to have the hands on hip, you can't make me strategy, or worse, they're going to have the Joey strategy, I'm banging my pencil, I hate this class, I hate you. The other problem with these traditional strategies is they don't teach anything about self-control. They don't teach anything about what should I do differently next time and how do I build a skill so that I'm not escalating in a conflict. These kind of aversive, negative techniques can agitate people. No human being likes to hear no. I'm not saying we shouldn't say no. I'm just saying that in these moments, if a student, again, who's already struggling, unraveling, having a hard time managing themselves and staying in control, if that student hears us say, now you have a negative consequence, they're very likely to be agitated. They may certainly be embarrassed because very often, I mean, think about the times that you've lost control. Most of us don't like that feeling, and we certainly don't like losing control in public. It's embarrassing. We feel bad about it afterwards. And our students are doing this in public, and it may be very embarrassing for them to receive our negative interaction. We also affect in a negative way our relationship with the student if all of our interactions or many of our interactions are of the negative type. Now, just an aside, we know that students who are the typical externalizing students, that is students who have issues with attention and impulsivity, who are a teacher's, just they can be a teacher's nightmare. They can make your teaching task very difficult. We know that those students often get as many as 15 negative comments or statements to every one positive. 15, stop that, no, not that way, redo it, no, you're wrong, put your feet on the ground, move your chair in. 15 of those to one, wow, Wow, that's amazing how you drew that beautiful dog. Human beings do best with a ratio of 8 to 1, particularly to learn new behavior. 8 positives to 1 corrective statement. So the students who often escalate are the ones who are hearing negatives the most, and they really need positives. Someone made a comment about a bribe. I'll get to that later. It's not a bribe, it's a salary. A bribe is illicit money that you give to someone for doing something under the table. It's unofficial. A salary is what you give someone for a job well done. And there are times that extrinsic motivation may play an important role. We can talk about later on, hopefully we'll get to how we do that well without undermining intrinsic, but we will, but sometimes you do need that. And in terms of the question on mixing academic with behavior, so if you are disrupting the class, you get a lower test grade or extra homework. I agree with your final statement, Melanie, that to some extent, we have to see each child as an independent universe and a little, for lack of a better word, an experiment in building that child. And in building that relationship, we have to work together with the child to see what works. And sometimes it does have to mean that you've disrupted the class so much that there's going to be a consequence on a test. I prefer keeping it separate. I agree. If you get everything right on the test, you should earn those points. But I wouldn't make an absolute hard, fast rule. So let's move to de-escalating. And what is it that we can do in the moment as a crisis is happening or escalating? What is it that we can do to make sure that we're not part of the problem, but that we're part of the solution? So the first thing I want to think about is how we are sensible in recognizing the impact of our senses. And the first sense I want to talk about is the sense of touch. So what is the physical space parameter like here? Am I more likely to escalate a student if I stand over them or if I get to eye level? Am I more likely to escalate a student if I am very, very close to them or if I respect their body space? I want you all now to try an experiment with me. Obviously, if you're listening to me while you're driving in the car, do not do this. But if you are in the safety of your home, I want you to stand up. And I want you to imagine that there's a student in front of you and who is having enormous difficulty, is being very disruptive, and is beginning to escalate. And I want you to put your right foot forward in front of your left foot so that your stance is a little bit open. Lean on your right forward foot and extend your finger pointing towards the student in question. And imagine yourself with this stance, forward on your right foot, finger extended, saying, "Joey, you really need to get started." Now, is that a de-escalating pose? I don't think so. You're in Joey's face. You're forward like you're going to attack him. Now, standing right where you are, just shift your weight back to your left foot. No weight on your right foot. Put your weight on your back foot, on your left foot, which is slightly behind the right one. Put your finger down. And now imagine saying the exact same words to Joey. "Joey, let's get moving with the homework. Come on. You can do it." Think how much different it feels. Do it again. Foot forward. Put your weight on your right foot. And now kick back. This is what Eva Feinler, who's an expert on anger management, calls the kick back strategy. When we are in a conflict, human beings, we tend, particularly when we're the person in authority, we tend to move our body forward into the conflict as a way to control, to manage, to contain. But in fact, it's a very attacking stance. And if we just kick back, that's the way I remember it, to kick back in these crises, your physical political stance communicates so much more, kind of calm, welcoming, and certainly not attack. Feel free to share your impressions if you did it on the chat, if you liked the difference in your body language when you kick back. In terms of sound, we have to think about everything, including the volume of our voice. Sometimes a whisper is so much more powerful than a scream. The tone of our voice. Young children don't understand sarcasm. They just hear it as meanness. And even older children, if there are language issues, if there are issues in language processing, if it's a child on the spectrum who's having difficulty understanding tone of voice, it could be misunderstood even though you're joking. Also, think about the ambient noise. For some children, the amount of noise is really horrible. And simply saying, Joey, come over here. Let's just talk outside the classroom where it's quieter, is the most important thing you could do to keep something from escalating, because the ambient noise in the room is going to make it virtually impossible. So in terms of de-escalating in our body language, we've already talked about the red ones in this slide are the no-nos, and the green are the de-escalating stances or body language approaches. So rather than facing, you know, pointing forward and finger in your face to kick back, believe it or not, putting your hands in your pockets, or, by the way, your hands behind your back, can escalate people because they don't know, what are you hiding? What are you about to do? Are you coming after me? Versus approaching someone with your hands at your side, your palms face up and open, no fists, nothing being held in your hands. Standing above is a no-no versus getting down to a child's level, meeting them at eye level. If they're sitting, then squat down so that you're at eye level to the child. And finally, in our culture, full facing, directly facing someone face to face, is seen as a confrontative stance. And angling your body just slightly is less escalating. It's less... It's less of a confrontation. Now, I will tell you, because for years I worked on in children's special education schools and in hospital settings where escalating crises could become physical and even quite dangerous, that the two advantages, by the way, of the kick back and the angled body are your safety. When you are kicked back, when your weight is on your back foot, if you need to move away from a crisis situation, you're halfway there. Whereas if you're forward into the face of the child, they can come at you much more quickly and you can get hurt. Also, when your body is angled, what you present to a potential confrontation, the side of your body is all soft tissue. There are no organs there that are going to get damaged. There's no solar plexus to have a wayward book, you know, hit as it's thrown. So for your own safety, it's a better stance for you. Now, what do we say when we're de-escalating? What should our words be? Consider, by the way, the role of choice. Choice short circuits negativity. The human brain doesn't like to be told, you must do this. But if we say to the exact same human brain, if we say you must do the homework now, that's a command, and we don't like, our brain does not like commands. It looks for an out. But if we say, would you prefer to do the math homework first, or would you like to review the reading? Now, by the way, that statement has kind of inherent in it that you're going to be doing homework. But because of the element of choice, the illusion of choice, or one might think of it as an actual choice, they're calming words. They tend to de-escalate. Sometimes, by the way, the choice we can give a student is simply, I hope that you will sit down and do the homework. But really, and students will say all the time, you can't make me. I would agree with them. I would say, you're right. I can't. It is your choice. I'm going to give you some time to think about it, and I hope you'll make a good decision. You often do. And I'll be back to check in a little while. And giving those, saying those words in a very calm way, which is called, by the way, reverse mirroring. The louder the student gets, the calmer and the softer we get. Because what happens if we meet loudness with louderness? I don't know if that's a word. But it escalates up the ladder like that. You get loud, they get louder. You get louder, they get louder than you. And it gets to a point where loud isn't enough and we get physical because we're frustrated or we push away or we storm out of a room. So if we do the opposite, if we meet loudness with increased calm, simple phrases, this is not a time for discussion. Simple phrases, I'm going to give you time to decide, I'll be back. Make a good choice, I hope you'll make a good choice, you often do. I'll be back in 5 to check on you. I'm over here if you need me. Lay out the options. You know, you could do your homework now, or you can take it home and do it tonight. I know you don't love having lots so at home, so it's up to you. I'm going to give you a few minutes to decide if you want to get started. I'll be back and check on you. By the way, not only does saying give a few minutes to check on it, but it allows you to go back and deal with the rest of the class and not have this interrupt your plan for the day. I love it. Chaim Yachnes is, I love the situation you shared, and that's exactly it. You can keep doing what you're doing, and then, again, it's a logical consequence, and then we won't have time to do anything fun that we wanted to do, but you could kind of settle in, and, you know, it's up to you to choose. Connie wants to know, Chaim, you'll have to fill her in on what happened. They want to know the end of the story. And by the way, nothing that we try is going to work 100% of the time. That's why, as I say again, as educators, we are constantly experimenting, seeing each day as kind of what's my research hypothesis today? What do I think will work? And I understand Musi's comment about, is it fair for the rest of the girls who are good? The reality is, it isn't fair, but if the class misbehaves, you're not going to get to those fun activities. That's the reality. Now, sometimes you have to be very, very careful about group dynamics. Sometimes saying that when there's one or two children that are causing the havoc in the classroom, you can scapegoat them, and then everybody else in the class is mad at them. So you have to be careful if that's a repetitive pattern. At other times, it can be very helpful because now the group says, come on, Chaim, we'll get your stuff packed out. We'll get everything ready. Come on, let's get going so we can do that fun stuff. And sometimes you turn the group attitude in a positive direction. Very important to focus on the present. When a child is escalating, by the way, it's true when your spouse is escalating or when your own children at home are escalating. Never use the word, never, always. You keep on, don't bring up the past. Healthy arguing, discussion, and fighting focuses in the moment. Nobody who is having a hard time wants to hear that this is the fourth time this week or that they always do this or that they never clean up after themselves. It just humiliates and frustrates them. So focus on the present. And this is a fine line because you might read what Chaim said and say, was what Chaim said a threat? Well, it sounds to me like you said it very nicely, and it was a simple statement of fact. I'm not threatening. It's a reality. If I'm not able to do A, B, and C in the lesson, then we don't get to the fun D and E parts. If we can get started with A, B, and C, we'll have plenty of time for fun. It's not a threat. I'm just telling you that's what's the reality. Okay. De-escalating. Can't see my slide because it's... we want to avoid power struggles, and I've already talked about how demands and directions invite anger and refusal. By the way, I also never want to make a demand or a direction that I can't make happen. So I don't want to say, you are doing your homework today no matter what. Well, I can't make them do his homework. I don't want to say, if you don't do this, you must leave the classroom. And what if I can't? I mean, you can't see me, but I'm only 5 feet tall. I'm not a very intimidating figure physically. After third grade, I can't physically make anybody do anything. They're all bigger than me. So I don't want to say things, and then I look weak because I can't make it happen. By the way, I also do not want to say, I don't want to do this. This is your last warning. One more time. I tell you, if you do this one more time. Now, no, I mean it. One more time. And you're, if it one more time, this is the last time. This is the absolutely last time. We then create a dynamic where students do not think what we say the first time matters, because we're always going to say, et cetera, that it's a problem. And Natasha, I agree that children are very forgiving for the behavior of certain children when it's affecting the class negatively. But I think that there are certain children who do get scapegoated for it. And it kind of depends on whether the behavior is what it is. For example, they'll be very, if they can see a child's disability, if the child has a hearing aid or walks with a crutch, they'll be very forgiving of the extra time it takes to include that child. Whereas a child with a temper tantrum or who has more behaviors that are annoying to other children, they're not always so positive. Avoid asking questions or seeking explanations in the moment of escalation. This is not the time to say, why are you so upset? What happened last night at home? Are things okay with your family? Is this homework hard for you? You may need all that information, and it may be really, really helpful. But it is not the time to be coming at a child with those what may feel to the child like a verbal attack, a verbal stripping away of their protection. So we have to be careful about that. Use a positive, optimistic frame. I like to think about it as, I always want to talk to the best part of that child. I don't want to talk to the part of the child that's losing it. I want to talk to the child that I know is in there, who, you know, yesterday did their homework, who can manage to do their work, who can settle down and be calm. And so I will talk about a reset walk and time away and time off and time out. I will talk about that, Ariel. Absolutely. I'm talking more about kind of your response and how we not prompt things getting worse. That will come to, you know, we're on it on this slide, actually. We're just coming up to it. But an optimistic frame is, you often make very good decisions. I hope you will today, but you know what your choices are. Whatever you choose, that's okay. I'll be back to check on you in a few minutes. Or you can come to me whenever you need it. There's a picture here of a calming caddy, creating a time and space for thinking, saying there's a space in the classroom. Do you need to use it? Would that help you right now? It's okay to ask those simple questions of a student. It's always been helpful before. Why don't you go think about it? You'll come back when you're ready. I know you always settle in very nicely. Prompt good behavioral options, like, you know, you're allowed to take a walk. You know, you're allowed to reset. You know, you could do your breathing, you know, et cetera. We can prompt for all those good options. Here's one caveat. We kind of have to teach those strategies first. If you tell a child who's throwing things all over your classroom, do you need to go out in the hallway and take a walk? They may be ripping things off the bulletin board when they're in the hallway. So we have to teach first what a reset walk is, what are the parameters of a reset walk, and in some cases, we don't want it to become a strategy for avoiding the classroom. We may have to say, you know, everybody in the class will have a time during a week when they need a reset walk. Each one of you have a reset walk coupon. Use it when you need it this week. But not that you have endless opportunities for it, or each student may come to you and say, I think I need a Reset Walk coupon today. I'm having a hard day. Okay. That's, you know, one of the goals, if I go back to the beginning, is that students be able to self-manage. If a student could come into my classroom and tell me, this is a really bad day for me. I am on edge. I'm afraid I'm going to lose it. Normally, you only let me take one Reset Walk in the morning, but I think I might need three. Is that okay? Now, to me, that's enormous progress, because here's a student who's trying to self-manage. Now, of course, it happens every single day. We need to reassess. You're out of the class more than you're in. We have to work on that. But the idea that a student is developing control is terrific. We want to emphasize safety as driving our actions. This is, by the way, another way of avoiding a kind of punitive stance. I like to say, the way that you're acting in the classroom right now isn't safe. It's not feeling safe to me for you to be on the playground right now. It's not feeling safe to have you use the markers right now. To use the word of safety, not I don't like how you're behaving. And Jennifer, thank you 100%. An ounce of prevention is worth about 30 tons of cure. If we see the signs that our class as a whole is struggling, and by the way, in first grade, we probably shouldn't do anything for more than 30 minutes. Maybe we shouldn't do anything for more than 15 minutes without breaking it up, without moving people around, letting people shake it out, changing the topic, changing the learning. The more we create a learning environment that is comfortable for everyone and that fuels them rather than zaps their strength and their energy, the less likely we are to have conflict. Very important concept. Validation is not agreement. Somebody posted, and you're 100% true, all children need validation. And even in their worst moments, they need validation. And when they're saying, homework is stupid, I hate homework, validation is, I know how you feel. I see it. I can see this is really upsetting you. That's validation. Agreement is, homework is the stupidest thing ever invented by mankind. We should totally do away with it. We do not need to agree with students who are escalating, but we do need to validate them. We do need to say, I hear you. Because if we don't say, I hear you, I get it, I know how you're feeling, then they have to show us until they know they've been heard. And they're going to show us by escalating. Make sure you don't promise what you can't deliver. Don't promise, don't say, you know what, we'll take care of homework. You'll never have to do homework. And this is also really important. Note and celebrate all attempts in a positive direction, even in the midst of a negative battle. If Joey pounding his pencil happened to flick something off of his desk and it went onto someone else's desk and Joey said, oh, Rachel, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that to go on your desk. I would immediately say to Joey, that was so lovely that you apologized to Rachel. That was really nice that you did that. That's a beautiful meet up. Even though he's having enormous trouble, but he did something wonderful. And that also can shift escalation because it's changing the relationship. Now, a word about peer-to-peer conflict. We so much want our students to get to a place where they can solve their own problems. We do not want them running to us every 2 minutes. She won't give me. He's not being nice. I don't think they're being fair. And we struggle, whether we're teaching first graders or whether we're teaching 11th graders, we struggle in terms of how much should we engage versus how much should we allow them to solve things on their own. My rule of thumb is that we cannot expect them to solve problems if they don't have the tools, and we shouldn't expect that they have the tools unless we've taught them to them. We do not say, even to college students or high school students, do calculus, unless we have taught them all of the parameters and the rules that you need to be able to do calculus. They can't, figure out the cosine of an angle if we haven't taught them geometry. They need the tools and they need to practice. Then we can prompt them. Well, I don't know how to find that angle. Well, remember Sokotoa? Remember those tricks that we use to find angles, etc.? Remember how we look at the Rashi in the first Pasuk? If we give them the tools, we can prompt them to use them. One school in California, I love it, they taught their students a particular way, a five-step process of social problem solving, and they printed it on the back of their IDs, which teachers wore all the time. So that anytime a student came to them and said, she's not, and it's not fair, he didn't, the teacher would turn over the ID and say, did you do your steps? Let's do them together. What's number one? Number one is state what the problem is. So did you do that? Do you know what the problem is? Okay. Number two is think of all my options. Okay. So did you think of your options, the two of you together? But because they had taught those steps, they could constantly prompt them and then send kids off on their own to solve the problem. I'm reading things in the chat room also. Yes, ignoring doesn't solve the problem, although sometimes we do have to ignore an escalating student because we have to go on with the rest of the lesson and with the rest of the class. And sometimes we don't want to give an enormous amount of attention, Kitsia. But what we can do is to say, I'll be back with you in a minute. I see. I know you're upset. So just acknowledge that I hear you, I see you, but I'm going to get this started and then we'll have a minute to talk. We have to, I love these brain breaks, Maximo Flow, Go Noodle, crossbody exercises, all of these, Jennifer, they're wonderful strategies. We need, like doctors, the Hippocratic Oath is, you know, do no harm. We have to avoid an intervention that will make things worse, like scapegoating a child, like embarrassing a child in front of the whole class, like giving a high-stakes negative consequence that's going to blow up. We need to understand the larger context, which may be complex, both in terms of there's a lot going on in this student's home. I know, I mean, we shouldn't know from it, and we're all thinking so much about what's happening in Israel today, but I was supposed to have a conference call with a colleague who's in Israel, and she said, I'm going to be late because my children are a little bit more upset than usual, and I can't get them to sleep. They've been out of school. She wrote to me later. They've been out of school for 2 days and in and out of shelters. So we have to understand that there may be other things going on that are causing this escalation, and therefore I may have to opt for a little bit more TLC and caring and caregiving and make my expectations a little bit looser than usual. Our prime mission always is safety, so we need to think about that. The steps concept, the truth is they don't use steps, they actually use a problem-solving strategy whose acronym is SODAS, S-O-D-A-S. You can Google it, but there, if you Google social problem solving, you will find tons of materials on the internet that teach social problem solving and that give you handouts and charts and graphics. And what's wonderful is, in this case, the whole school adopted the same steps. So whether you were a first grader or a seventh grader, you were learning the same strategy, and it was being articulated grade after grade after grade. So there was a lot of redundancy and overlearning that took place. Some general considerations. The best way to change student behavior is to change adult behavior. If we are tired when we walk in the classroom and we know our patience is limited, then we need to think about, maybe this is not the day that I'm going to do that activity that really requires me to be very, very patient with the students. Maybe this is a day that I have to do some brain breaks, et cetera. Thank you for the SODAS options there. I've already said the value of prevention, that discipline, when we have to discipline, we should always think that the word discipline comes from the word disciple. The question we should always be asking is, what am I teaching here? Am I teaching Joey anything if I say to him, is today going to be like yesterday, Joey? I don't think so. I don't think I'm teaching anything of value with that statement. But if I say to Joey, what are some of the things that usually help you get started? And can I help you with some of those now? Or if I say, Joey, let's chat. Something's going on this morning. Let's find some time to talk. Let me get everybody else started. Then I'm teaching him that there are options. The more structure and pre-taught routines we have in place, the less reactive we need to be and less reactive our students need to be. And the more tools we all have, the more likely they'll succeed. And by the way, we need to know our triggers. We need, I love it, Bracha, thank you. I was going to say, we need to show our students externally what we often are doing internally. So we may be really upset at the 8,000 times the PA system interrupts our lesson today. And the 8,001st announcement comes over the PA system. And rather than gritting our teeth, imagine and doing our internal working of saying, I can't lose it in front of the kids, in front of my students. Imagine actually saying, you know what, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a frustrating day, hasn't it? With all these interruptions, I could get very angry, but that's not going to help me teach, and I don't think it's going to help you learn. I'm going to do some deep breathing. Remember how we did our deep breathing exercises, hand on our chest and hand on our belly? Why don't we do them together? You want to do them? I'm going to do 3 deep breaths. Do you want to do some deep breaths with me? Let's all do them together. It's wonderful. And then it's a fantastic way to subtly model without saying, do as I do. And they will copy you. In the context of a caring relationship, as you deal with students who are struggling, realize that humor can go a long way, never making fun of a student. But if you can laugh together about something, that can be, it can break the ice, it can move things in a different direction. Make sure that you let the student save face, and particularly with young children, redirection and distraction is amazing. You know, preschoolers, first graders, they have, you know, the attention span of a gnat. They really, really, really want something, but you can hold something shiny over in the other corner and they're distracted and redirected. Use prompts. If you have found that Joey and you have a secret signal for when he doesn't want to do his homework or the homework is difficult and he needs some help, prompt that. Prompt him to use his cues. Prompt him to use his strategies. What you can always do is take your unspoken, unwritten curriculum and make it clear. If you are a teacher who doesn't want people to call out, then make sure they know what are the procedures to get recognized. And consider starting on the right foot with actual lessons that teach this curriculum. Do you, in your classroom, teach students what to do when work is too hard for them? Do you teach them what to do when they get frustrated? Do you teach them how to solve a problem? And I mean, if you're teaching them the steps on how to solve a math problem or how to decode a difficult Rashi or how to look at a Perush on the Chumash, then why not say, what did we learn from doing this that might help us deal with a problem in life in general? Every one of us as educators will be offered endless teachable moments where we can congratulate, we can shape, and we can partner with our students to grow healthy behavior. I didn't put the quote in here, although I use it so often. Chaim Ganat, an amazing educator, said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, I won't get it exactly right, but I've come to the frightening conclusion that I am the pivotal force in a child's life. It's my actions that determine whether a child will be torn apart and humbled or whether a child will be supported and elevated. In the classroom, I can humiliate or I can heal. It's all up to me. You've been an incredibly, I can't wait to read.
Thank you, Rona. You know, I was scribbling down all the questions as they came on, but then they kept getting answered.
Amazing question. I want to just say a word about consistency. Consistency is wonderful. What's more important is first of all, I think it was the Piaget's Etzner Rebbe who said the greatest inequity in the world was treating different people exactly the same. So consistency and fairness are two different things, and the sameness and fairness are two different things. So it isn't consistent to treat every student in your classroom exactly the same way, because some need more of something and some need less of something. But you do have to be fair about it. And consistency is a wonderful goal to strive for, but we can't all be exactly the same on Monday as we are on Friday afternoon. So when we are human and imperfect, we just have to admit that. And we can say to our students, you know, Friday afternoons are hard to teach. All of our heads are already in Shabbos. We're already gone, but we, you know, we have to stay focused just a little while longer. What can we do to do that? And thank you all for all your wonderful suggestions in the chat room.
Yeah, we had a very, very, very rich chat. So that was fabulous. One quick last question. Consequences, quote unquote, matching the crime. I know you had some conversation before, you know, in terms of motivation, extrinsic, intrinsic.
Back to it. Thanks, Sarah. So here's the thing about intrinsic and extrinsic and consequences. We all respond better to positives than negatives. So to the extent that we can offer a positive for the absence of negative behavior, it's better than punishing negative behavior with a negative. So I don't want you calling out. I could punish you when you call out, or I can offer a positive congratulations, reward, incentive, et cetera, when you raise your hand and wait to be called on. I'm not going to get arguments about offering you positives for positive behavior. I am going to escalate and get arguments when I punish your negative behavior. In terms of offering a positive, Rob March, who's one of the experts in shaping behavior in a positive way, says positives should have no salt, no sugar, and cost no money. They shouldn't be tangible rewards. They should leverage our investment in a relationship with our students, and they should be logical, and they should be us. So, for example, Chaim's example was perfect. I will be so pleased if we settle down and get to work that I have three amazing fun activities I can't wait to do with all of you. Or this particular student did a wonderful job. I want to give this particular student 5 minutes of shooting hoops at recess with me. Or I'm not a particular, you know, it's not so great to shoot hoops with Rona Novick, so maybe I invite you to tea in the classroom with me. Or I love adult coloring books, so I share a page of my adult coloring book with you and we do some coloring together. You have to be creative, but none of it works if you don't matter to the students. So relationship is important. And when you use extrinsic motivation not to control, that's what prisons do. Prisons use, you know, you can earn cigarettes. We're trying to control your behavior. You're not doing it to control. You're doing it to teach and to give feedback and to show the student you're on the right track. This is fantastic self-management. This is exactly a sign of fantastic growth. I want you to know that, and that's why I'm offering you, again, not the bribe, but this salary for a job well done.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for that clarification.